My guest today in the science studio is Leon Lederman, Director Emeritus of Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, or Fermilab, winner of the 1988 Nobel Prize in Physics with Melvin Schwartz and Jack Steinberger for their discovery of the muon neutrino. And he's the founder of the Illinois Mathematics and Science Academy. So, Leon, welcome.
Thank you.
We talked yesterday a great deal at a conference about the science of educating, and this is one of your passions. Would you like to tell me what you think the state of science education is in this country or in general?
Well, it depends on how you count it. If you count the efforts to improve it, it's enormous. I mean, there are efforts going all over the country, clever people, well-meaning people, experienced people, amateurs, parents, concerned citizens, scientists, worrying about the state of science education. So there must be something they're worried about. And if you take stock of our system, there are various ways you can do that. You find disquieting information everywhere you look. Our cities are still doing poorly. Poverty still governs the pace at which you can beat it by educating poor kids in the cities. And we're not doing a very good job there. We still have our very bright people. Somehow they manage to cope with even schools that are not appreciative of their talents, and a lot of them survive and are rescued in the better high schools and universities. But if you hold to any of the international measurements that compare student bodies, we're down there in the lowest quarter or third and so on. And in some places, especially our seniors in high school, who are, in fact, purposefully and voluntarily studying science, scored way down at number 16 out of 16 nations. The tests, the international tests, are very good. There were a lot of criticism that you don't test fairly, but all those criticisms have been answered by serious educators who are trying to make a measurement of the success or failure of educational systems. And we're down there with Lower Slovenia someplace, and we're not doing well for one of the richest countries in the world. I guess we're not rich anymore. We're now a debtor country, right? So maybe one of the poorest rich countries in the world. We clearly are not doing well. And our industries recognize this. There's a distinct air of concern about whether we can cope in this 21st century with a science and technology that's bounding forward ever more rapidly. If we can't keep up with that and we can't supply our rational industries, the IBMs and Microsofts and Motorolas and so on, we can't supply them with good scientists and good engineers and good technicians, there's going to be a suffering in this country.
So, but what happened? I mean, let's go back a little bit before we talk about the solutions and so on. So you were born in 1922 in New York. Oh. Where did your parents come from? What was the background?
They came from Europe. They were European immigrants. My father came when he was 18, my mother when she was 14 or something like that. They met in New York. But they were part of this large immigration from Eastern Europe that followed World War I. And
Russia? You say?
Yes, they came from Russia. And
I think I read somewhere that your mother arrived with a little tag on it.
Yeah, with a name and address of some relative of hers that was going to find her when she got off the ship and passed through immigration in New York. She somehow survived all that. And there was Leon, and he went to school with his older brother Paul, and we went to public school. And I don't remember too much about the public schools except that I enjoyed them. They were interesting, fun, and I kept looking for ways to impress my teachers. I remember one weekend before Christmas, the last day of school before Christmas, and a Santa Claus came to the room, and all the kids were very excited. This was probably first grade, kindergarten or first grade, and I said, "That's not really Santa Claus. I can see he's wearing a mask, you know." Teacher said, "Shut up," or words to that effect. Don't spoil it for the other kids.
Early scientist.
Early scientist. And so my school was very good, and I think the teachers were very good. Well, this was post the Great Depression that savaged the country in the 1930s and 20s especially, the 29 crash. And having a job as a teacher was a very, very good job. You were secure. You were relatively well paid. You were working. And so I remember high school was very dramatic. We had moved out of Manhattan to the farming suburbs called the Bronx. You know, there were cows and chickens and so on and farms there. And a subway line that had just completed. And we lived sort of almost on the shores of Pelham Bay in the eastern Bronx. And the school was very good. It was two blocks from our house, the high school, and teachers were, I remember, enjoying classes very much, enjoyed math. We were very impressed by a very young lab assistant. That was his job. He cleaned the lab and prepared the laboratory experiments for the students. And we spent a lot of time with him back in the lab, and he taught us how to blow glass, make glass structures, and use our hands, and he said that was very important. He was studying for a PhD in night school, you know, and working in the daytime in the school, and he made a big impression. I've always considered that the younger your teacher is, the more you'll pay attention, closer they are to your age. And in fact, probably the biggest influence on me in those times was not so much the teachers were positive, but my fellow students. Some of them were more experienced than I was in the world. My best friend's mother and father were teachers, and they would go to Europe in the summer, and he was very knowledgeable on the world, the real world. And he inspired me. You know, he talked to me. He knew a lot more about the world, and he read more than I did. And I remember being very, very moved by him.
So that whole ethos, though, I mean, I've talked to other people like Richard Axel, Eric Kandel, and so on. There's this whole influx of people running away from something, then states and going up in that area.
Rolling up their sleeves and contributing.
Going to Columbia and so on. Was science always something that you were attracted to?
I was turned on by a book written by Einstein, and I think it was written for children, and he had a co-author. I don't remember his name. I think the book was published around the 30s, and it was very inspiring because it compared science to a detective story, you know. There are clues, a bloody glove, a white Ford, a barking dog. Maybe those weren't the clues he had, but at the end, the butler did it, and every clue is accounted for. And he said, science is like that. The world is full of clues as to the mechanisms and how the world works. And by studying those clues, you have to come up with a story which says, here's how it was in the beginning, and here's why all these things happen. Here's why the day is 24 hours long, and the Earth spins on its axis and goes around the sun. And you're looking always for the simplest explanations for the clues you see.
But then they get complicated. If there was a poll done in England last year. There was in the newspaper. They asked them some simple questions. Why is the sky blue? Why does salt dissolve in water? What happens when you switch a light on? How old is the Earth? Things like that. You'd think people would know or have some sort of a sketchy answer for. And they gave these questions to a panel of scientists and science writers and people who should have known the answers. And they were fairly ludicrous answers, most of them.
Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, why is the sky blue is not an easy question.
It's not an easy question. In fact, that's a good example of how we can get kids to be interested in atoms. You know, more abstract explanations. Because you have to discuss colors and the blue, what is blue, and why is this tablecloth blue? Well, white light is a mixture of all colors, and if you absorb the red out of the scheme, like the chemicals in this dye that swallows up the red, then you reflect the blue. So it looks blue because of that. And so that's the story of, then you can ask again the question, if you're really nasty, you'll say, how does the red absorb the colors? And pretty soon you're led down to atoms and the structure of atoms and the fact that it's these oscillating electrons that produce the color. And if they oscillate in one particular way, you might get red, and another way you'll get purple. And it's the structure of atoms that is the basis and almost the answer to all those questions. In some ways, for almost all those questions you ask, give you an arrow of explanation which comes down to atoms. And then, of course, if you're not satisfied, you could say, what about these atoms? How did they get there? What's their explanation? And then you get down to another level of explanations.
And pretty much you're back at the Big Bang and the beginning of the universe.
That's right.
Which you were present at, right?
Actually, that's right. That's right. And so that's a good answer to a congressman who says, why are we spending all this money? Well, it's always a good question. And I think the profit of answering these questions is so enormous that it shouldn't really be continuously asked, but you always have to continue educating, never stop explaining how science works, because it is somewhat subtle and takes effort to keep explaining it. But the lessons of the profit of learning how the world works is huge.
So you mentioned Einstein. You actually met Einstein once.
Yeah, it was a funny thing. We had a powerful 30-second conversation, two of us.
How did that come about?
Well, I was in graduate school at Columbia studying particle physics, and my friend was was studying theoretical physics, quantum theory at MIT, and a mutual friend of ours was down at Princeton in the math department, and he said, I met Einstein's assistant, and if you guys want to meet Einstein, come down to Princeton and I'll tell you what to do and you'll meet him. Wow. So we quickly arranged to meet down at Princeton. We went there. We saw our friend, showed us a bench to sit on. He says, the master passes by here with his assistant going to lunch every day about 12:15. So sit here and you'll get introduced. And we just so nervous. Waited, and sure enough, along came the old man, and roughly 1950, so.
You remember how he dressed? And
oh, yeah, with a shabby sweatshirt and sandals. And traditionally, he never wore socks, so we spotted this as he came towards us. And they were getting close. His assistant said, would you like to meet some students? Ja, he says. That's a German accent, ja.
Okay.
Otherwise, I would say yes, but he said, yeah. And so we jumped up, and he asked my friend, he says, well, what do you do? And his friend says, well, I'm doing a thesis on quantum theory. Einstein shrugged and said something we were not too surprised about, because his opposition to the quantum theory was well known. He says, ah, you're wasting your time, smiling, you know. So I felt better, because I'm doing an experiment on electron, on pions, you know, pi mesons, you brand new kind of particle. And so he's, what are you doing? And I explained to him that we have an accelerator and we're making pi mesons and we're understanding the properties of these new particles. And he waved his hand and he says, we don't understand the electron. Why do you bother with these other particles? So, he says, goodbye, boys, good luck. And he keeps walking, and we had spent, he had disposed of us both in about 30 seconds. But we were in cloud nine. We had spoken to the world's greatest scientist. His aura is enormous. And if you ever doubt it, and you go read what he achieved, as a single person, the special theory of relativity and the general theory of relativity, he was so far, he was alone out there in the territory of explaining the world in a way no one else did. I mean, the 20th century has two pillars of physics. One is relativity theory, and the other is the quantum theory. Quantum theory was developed by a huge number of people: Niels Bohr, Schrödinger, Heisenberg, Born, Planck, Einstein also. All Europeans, and all contributing something to this new theory, which by late 1920s gave us a tremendous, powerful way of understanding atoms, because data from the atoms just began to appear in the late 1800s. The electron was discovered in 1897. And when the electron was discovered by J.J. Thomson in England, the English dons would always have a toast. They say, "Ladies and gentlemen, let's drink to the electron. May it forever remain useless." See, and however, Mr. Congressman, the electron wasn't useless. In fact, it's the basis of all of our, you know, modern technology, and followed by the quantum theory, which explains its behavior in atoms. It probably accounts for some huge fraction, 92.7% of the gross national product. Incidentally, 85.3% of all numbers are made up.
I read somewhere that your actual ambition was to be a stand-up comic, and you just sort of drifted into physics.
I had to do something between jokes, pass the time.
So in terms of, you talked about those two twin pillars and so on, but if you pick up any magazine now, let's say a popular science magazine, it's baffling to most people in terms of the debates that are going on within physics. I mean, is there enough dark matter in the universe to stop it from flying off the edges of the table? Is string theory correct? The debates there are still roiling.
Well, the debates,
what's going on?
The frontier is always tentative. And at the frontier, because it's a frontier, by definition, there are many different points of view on how to resolve the puzzles that we have. Now, we've always had puzzles going all history of science is a history of solving problems. You might point to the modern epoch, which is Galileo and Newton, so that's, say, 1600 roughly. They overlapped. I think Newton was born within a few years of Galileo's death, so mm-hmm. It was a continuum. And it was Galileo, I guess, who began the notion of a mathematical explanation for phenomenon. You know, we had these two students on top of the Leaning Tower, and the question is, the skinny student and the fat student, if we pushed them both off at the same time, which would land first, the heavy student or the light student? So he listened for squishes. If he heard only one squish, that landed simultaneously. Well, maybe it was just stones, but graduate students sounds better. They're always available. But the notion that these two objects fall with the same speed was totally unexpected. You know, there's a story. The science generally, and by historians, started in thousand years ago, and probably B.C. 1500, somewhere around there, where the Greeks were given credit for asking why things happen and looking for explanations. And then along came in 400 B.C. Democritus. There was no Republicanos. There was only a Democritus, if you want to make political capital of that. Mr. Democritus first had a model that matter is composed of small objects and space, and the small objects move randomly in space. It was a pretty good model for our present atomic theory. And in fact, tomos is the Greek word for cut, and atomos is something that you cannot cut. Mm-hmm. And so his notion was that if you take a piece of cheese, it's Greek, so it's feta cheese, and you cut it in half, and you continually cut it, imagining an infinitely sharp knife. He says eventually you'll come to a speck of cheese, invisible to your eye because it's so small, but uncuttable. And that was called atomos. Later became atom. That's because the chemists don't understand Greek. They misnamed it. We're stuck with atom. We know that our atoms can be taken apart, so that's the problem. But the notion, that whole imagination of how matter looks, and then he had different kinds of particles that would give rise to the different properties of matter. And occasionally these particles would stick together, and eventually you might see the leaf of a flower or a drop of dew on the leaf, something like that, would come from an accumulation of these small objects. So that was atomic physics. But it didn't go much further than that. It was an idea that was believed in by Galileo and Newton, but they had no way of verifying it by experiments. And that didn't come about until the late 19th century, like the discovery of the electron. And 15 or so years later, Rutherford discovered the nucleus of the atom, and then we had a picture of the atom. And then we didn't understand how the atom worked, and there was there was the same disagreement between scientists about how the atom works and pictures of the atom. And one picture said there's a central positive nucleus with electrons outside, the correct picture, and there were other pictures that said, no, it's not that way. The positive charge is on the outside and the negative charge is in the middle. They had different pictures of the atom because there was everybody was entitled to an opinion until you did experiments.
So it's business as usual as far as you're concerned.
That's right. Now we're in a controversy about a new frontier, totally different frontier, a new frontier possibly in distance, certainly in space and time, which has to do with this dark energy that is a favorite of Sunday supplements and science magazine articles, because it is a great puzzle. And as long as it's a puzzle, there'll be all kinds of theoretical physicists. You know, they're the kind that sleep late. They wander in saying, I've been working all night, you know, and that's not true. They just sleep late.
As opposed to high-energy physicists
who work hard,
bounding
they
around.
Take lead bricks and stack them up and do hard physical labor. But they're it's fun and interesting, and they do suggest different ways you can try to cut to the observation, because ultimately, like all the other problems we've had in science, especially in physics, they get solved by observation, and then more speculation about how to make that observation mathematically valid. You put it together and you have to join it to the vast amount of information we have already on gravity and how gravity works. It's really it has something to do with gravity and something to do with the general theory of relativity, and maybe we're going to find some important modification. Whatever it is, it's going to change our worldview in a very serious way.
When lots of these large discoveries are made, statements are often issued, like Einstein talking about the mind of God, or Spinoza's God, or Stephen Hawking talking about the mind of God, a theory of everything, or George Smoot, when discussing the background radiation, talking about the handwriting of God, or you have a book called The God Particle. And then Steven Weinberg sort of complains about all this and says, well, this is just using the word as an extraction, really. It's all about equations. So why do we always reach for this metaphysical, spiritual description?
I can't answer for many of the other people. In my case, it was merely a device to sell books. Commercial. I'd always worked on that book, and I called it The Higgs Particle. Was the working title, because the Higgs Particle has plagued us for many years. It was the motivation for building an accelerator in Texas, which eventually was canceled by Congress. And it's one of the driving items in the accelerator that's nearing completion in Europe now, into which the U.S. fortunately is making a strong contribution. But so it was going to be the Higgs particle, but my editor correctly pointed out that no one ever heard of Higgs. How are we going to sell books on a particle that's named after someone never heard of? And I was bored with the issue, and I said, okay, you know, you name it. And he came up with the God particle, and I said, wow, all right. I had secretly hoped that it would be made into a movie. And the God I refer to in my movie is a woman. And I thought Margaret Thatcher would be willing to play that part at the time. You know, arrogant and tough and knows how to lead. Very experienced.
Well, actually, on that point, You have in The God Particle, where you're describing Shelley Glashow's promotion of a fourth quark that he calls charm. You mention one of the authors of a review paper was Mary Gaillard.
Yes.
And then you say in parentheses, one of the tragically few women in physics.
Yes.
Now, I've been thinking about that, and if I think about women physicists now, and this is playing off the Margaret Thatcher thing, I can certainly think of Lisa Randall, I can think of Maria Spiropoulou, but that's it.
Yeah.
And it's I'm sure there are.
Yeah.
But
it's a problem.
It's still a problem.
Oh, yes. I think the last number I saw for women PhDs in physics, it's like 20%. Hmm. And that's not enough. You know, why isn't it 50%? I don't know why it isn't 50%. I think a lot of it is still a cultural problem that young women are not encouraged into science by their parents or by their advisors in school. You know, this is science. You don't want to do science, dear. You're a girl. You want to cook and so on. That cultural handicap is still with us. It should have gone away long ago because, you're rightly saying, that some of these women scientists, Lisa Randall is one of the, probably would be on everybody's best 10 list of active scientists today. So there's absolutely no logical reason why that's so. There is a reason. In fact, there was this article someone mentioned yesterday, the gender problem, and mm-hmm. we saw that in our school. I have the School for Gifted Kids, and one of the young ladies walking out of the physics class was overheard by her teacher talking to a friend saying, "When I'm in this class, I feel like I'm swimming in a pool filled with sharks." And she said it loudly enough for the teacher to hear, and so later the teacher called her over and said, "Well, what did you mean? I heard you." Well, she said, "I meant you to hear me." "Well, what did you mean?" "Well," she said, "you ask a question, and I'm thinking, what does that question have to do with the subject matter that you're teaching us? And before I'm even, you know, into the reason for your asking the question, six guys have jumped up to give you the answer. You know, they're too fast. And that's what makes me feel as if I'm competing with them." Well, he was interested in this, so he asked permission to teach an all-girls class. And permission was granted. And he taught the all girls, and after about 3 weeks, he found that the all-girls class was about, I don't know, a week or two behind the mixed class he was also teaching. And he noticed he was teaching differently to the girls' class, deeper, slower, more reasoned. And this got into the newspapers and got on national television as an interesting gender problem. And then we get a call from the state authority saying, "You're not allowed to teach an all-girls class. It's illegal." I didn't know it was illegal. I thought it was a stupid rule. Why can't we teach an all-girls? Well, apparently, it was a law passed mindlessly to be gender neutral. Don't teach an all-girls class. So we gave up on it, but I think we had learned something important that was illustrated by the article in Times, that there is a gender difference in how people learn. There's a gender difference within any particular group on how children learn, how young people learn. We know that the learning process is a very specific process. It's not one size fits all. And so I think that that separating, once we understand what the difference is deeply, then we can do something about it, either by having gender-separate lessons or by having a teaching style that encourages both types of minds, the more contemplative, deeper mind, or these guys who want to quickly show that they're superior, you know, and jump up and give the answers quickly. There's a problem. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of other problems in education that we're learning about in the kind of work that we were talking about yesterday. I think that's something to really be optimistic about. We are learning a lot about how the brain works and how learning should be done. But we're not learning fast enough to overcome the handicaps we have in a chaotic educational system. You know, I'm old enough to look at the national scene on education, and I find that there's a lot to be discouraged about, that children are turning off from science when they should be turning on. You know, Carl Sagan was famous to say, children are all scientists. Why? Because they ask questions. And they come in asking questions. And that's very positive, but they get turned off. So by the time they're in fourth or fifth or sixth grade, and of course there are exceptional teachers who will encourage the asking of questions, because that's what a scientist is. He asks questions. Once you ask the question, you've gotten three quarters of the problem solved, because now you can go ahead and say, aha, that's the question. Here's how I will go about answering it. But the ask the question is the key point in scientific progress, and it's the key point in learning things. Kids want to know. And they come into classroom with amazing misconceptions, fascinating ones. And there's, you know, the art of teaching, and that's where we're also can do so much better. The art of teaching is to seek out these misconceptions and, with the help of the child, try to show the child how these misconceptions are not in accord with how the world works.
Can you think of an example?
Oh, many examples. One example, the teacher will, throw shadows on the wall, you know, with a sharp light, point source of light, and you get very sharp shadows. Put your hair there, you see fine. And you say, you see, kids, light travels in straight lines. It goes in straight lines. And the kids say, yes. And if there's a test, what does light do? They'll all write down, light travels in straight lines. But it didn't mean a thing to them, because to them, light doesn't travel. The idea that light travels is crazy. Light shines. You know, well, a teacher might show you that here's a hot water and here's cold water, and you mix them, and heat flows from high temperatures to low temperatures. You have a rock that you've heated up and it's hot, and there's a cold rock nearby, and eventually they come to thermal equilibrium. See, heat flows from hot to cold. Again, heat feels, it doesn't flow. The notion that heat flows is a notion that the teacher got from classes, but the children don't have that notion. So there are these misconception examples of misconceptions, and it's a glorious exercise in good education to root them out, because unless you root them out, they'll stay there and grow right through high school and college.
Somebody pointed out at the meeting yesterday that that it can take at least 10 years for research that's in current journals to actually make its way into textbooks.
I would think 10 is very optimistic. My guess is it's more like 30 years or so, but okay.
So essentially, kids are learning things that are 30 years out of date.
Oh, much more worse. It's much worse than that. I mean, you've touched on the whole problem. Our curriculum, this nation's curriculum in high schools, is about 100 years. Well, it was carved out 100 years ago in a famous committee, a national commission, appointed by the president, chaired by the president of Harvard, of course. Who else would do that? And they came up with a sequence in which students take biology first, and then after biology, they take chemistry, and after chemistry, they take physics. Perfectly okay in 1900, perfectly okay in 1920, totally wrong today, just backwards. It's wrong because we learned in the 20th century a lot about chemistry, a lot about physics, talked a little bit about the quantum theory. We understand so much more now than we did then, and that curriculum is just backwards. So you look at open up your child's ninth grade biology book, and still 98% of all high schools teach biology in ninth grade, and it's full of long Latin words that are memorized. And I remember my grandson, he memorized, in the first 10 pages I had 20 or 30 words, I had no idea what they meant, a lot of syllables. But my grandson, he knew what they meant, but he said, as soon as I pass the test, I'll forget these words, because that's what happened last week. You know, that's not science. The only subject that really gives not only a knowledge of how the world works to students, but gives a knowledge of how science works to students. And that's if you do the simple things. You throw a ball up in the air. It comes down. Why does it come down? A car. What? Newton taught us that in order to have a change of motion, you have to have a force. Okay, so there's a car at rest, and somehow, broom, broom, noise, and the car goes off. what force acted on the car? Well, it's a nice question to ask mom and dad and so on, and you get answers. Well, the motor. But the motor is inside the car, so it can't really push on the car. What's pushing on the car? A lot of answers come, and finally somebody says, well, the only thing that's pushing on the car is the road. It's the only thing touching the car from the outside is the road. In fact, if the road is full of ice and icy, the car won't go. Wheels will turn, the car stands still. So the road must be very important. Okay, this kind of thinking is what starts you off in physics and gives you a feeling for how science works. Because here you take Newton's equation, the simple equation. Now, one of our problems is Algebra 1 should be a 7th or 8th grade course, and it isn't. In most schools, it's a 9th grade course. So you're taking math and you're taking physics simultaneously. That's okay if the teachers can talk to each other. So you get another problem. Teachers don't have time to talk to each other. Now, when I'm elected president, I expect to run, not this time, but next time, I'm going to make sure that teachers have maybe 20% of their time free to talk to other teachers. It's part of their job. That'll be expensive. Like, add 20% to the total salary of all education. I don't know if it's 2 weeks or 3 weeks in Iraq, but it's, I think, eminently affordable to give teachers more time to become better teachers. In Asia, teachers are given a huge amount of time to be better teachers. Collegially, they talk to each other, and then if there's something new in the newspapers, they'll call in a university guy to say, what's this dark energy? Kids are excited by it. I want to be able to explain whatever it is we can explain. Anyway, we're beating on this problem. We've got a lot to do in this country. There are a lot of efforts, and you know very much here in your organization, you're very concerned about fixing education. But fixing it is a huge job because we have this terrible system. We have 50 states, I think, when I last counted. We have 15,000 school districts, each with a superintendent. We have legislators who are interested. They vote the money for the schools. We have teachers and teachers' unions that restrict your total freedom to do things. On the other hand, there are positive aspects into all of these things. You have schools that train teachers. Are they doing a good job? And I'll tell you for sure that in primary school, teachers come out of those schools ignorant of math and science. They want to be good teachers. They love to be good teachers. They were never asked to learn enough math and science to take these young scientists who are coming in full of questions and blow on that flame and get it into a roaring inferno. That's what teachers, good teachers, would do. And teachers need to be trained to do that. So we have a big problem in that score everywhere you look. And right now, my biggest anger is with the universities. Yes, universities are not doing a good job. They do not continue the inspiration that kids getting out of high schools have about science. The teachers and the students that are getting out of high school who say, I'm a science major, I love chemistry, I love biology, and then they go to college, and 50% of those kids change fields into non-science fields. That's the statistical data. Why? Because they go into a class of 200 kids, and they see a small professor somewhere down there, you know, or maybe a teaching assistant whose English is not so good. The blame is in the university. It's depersonalized. You know, kids in high school, okay, at least there's 20 or 30 kids in a class. In these lecture rooms for Physics 1 or Chemistry 1, they're huge. I think it's UCLA, at least at one point, had an auditorium with 400 kids. All there sitting there listening to this one professor. You can hardly, you know, see him, binoculars. Oh, there he is. He's down there. And
didn't they try? You were saying that they tried this notion of physics first in this area, in the San Diego area. What happened?
Well, I've been working on this for 10 years. Probably, we have somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 high schools who have changed the sequence from biology first to physics first. And I get emails every week from a school that's on the verge of doing this, has done this, wants advice and so on how to do this, wants more details on what sort of a physics curriculum. Here in San Diego, it's a really sad story because they had a very good science teacher, leader of the science department and a very good board, and they decided they would install physics first. So, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, 9,000 kids registered for physics in ninth grade, and they did a lot of preparation. They trained the biology teachers, they trained physical science teachers, you know, middle school teachers, to teach conceptual physics in ninth grade. Conceptual physics means it concentrates on concepts rather than on mathematics, although you bring the mathematics in as gently and as, and yet, and, you know, to prepare the students that ultimately you really have to do it mathematically, but you don't have to do that now. You can grasp concepts now. Apparently, and there were a lot of problems, but after 2 or 3 years of stumbling and of teacher experiences increasing and so on, it began to work successfully. But by then, parents had organized, and I think, as I understand it, in two groups. One group said, you're watering down the physics. You shouldn't teach physics without mathematics. You've got to have physics, you've got to have calculus and so on, which is not true. I mean, physics is a conceptual subject, and it's concepts that you have to grasp. The mathematics is enormous convenience and probably essential if you're doing research, but these kids are not doing research. They're beginning to investigate how we understand the world. And another set of parents said, oh, the physics is too hard. You know, Junior doesn't have that grasp, which reminds me of the story of the, Willie, it's time to go to school. Get up. No. What do you mean, no? I'm not going to school. Willie, you got to go to school. Come on, you'll be late. No, I don't want to go to school. Why not? The kids hate me. The teachers hate me. I don't want to go to school. Willie, I have 2 reasons why you have to go to school. You're 40 years old and you're the principal. Is that relevant? No, I don't know.
Well.
I was trying to get you on a different subject.
Well, a lot of the talk yesterday was about, it was in fact about this disparities in the different constituencies in this huge education problem.
That's right. So, no country has the burden we have. Another interesting story is I worked a lot in Chicago with primary school teachers. We organized to teach the primary school teachers how to teach science to children. Mm. And we stole a lot of material from the Lawrence Hall of Science, beautiful material, right out of Piaget's advice for how children learn, how anybody learns. And this is beautiful materials in which the kids do experiments, and the teacher has this inquiry method of not telling, you know, asking a question, immediately giving the answer, but, extorting the answer from children's thinking. That's what you have to do in elementary school, and the teachers aren't trained to that. So we decided to train teachers, and we investigated this. And with experience, it took us 2.5 years of getting 80 hours somehow out of the teacher, because these were working teachers. You know, we got them in the evenings. We had substitutes of different ways of teaching these teachers, and it started to work. And a friend of mine from Paris came to visit, and I took him to some of our schools. And he watched the procedure. The furniture is different. They don't sit in rigid stools and benches, but they're around the table. And there's a guy with a kid with a stopwatch, and they're catching soap bubbles and measuring things. He was just blown over. That's called bouleversé in French. Mm-hmm. And he went back to France, and he talked to one gentleman called the Minister of Education. Within a year, training of teachers in this kind of teaching was in 800 schools in France. And they gave it a name, La Main à la Pâte. I have a book somewhere that translated into English. Beautiful things, and it's spreading over Europe like oobleck. You know, it's a contagious, wonderful way of teaching children how to think scientifically. So that's the advantage. Here, we have the Chicago Public Schools, and if one superintendent is encouraging, but he goes off to a different job and someone else comes in, you may blow the whole program. Over and over again, we've had, uh, well, when, in teaching and spreading the notion that physics ought to be the first step. We've had over and over again examples of unthinking superintendent. Most superintendents are not scientists. They don't understand science, and they decided that all the kids in this school are going to have to take a crucial exam in 10th grade, and it'll be biology. Well, that kills physics in 9th grade. You can't do it. So you have this complicated problem of diversity, disconnecting, and we 50 states and a poor teacher who is used to the methods in Alabama and moves to Minnesota. It's like a foreign country. So we've got to get, we have to inject coherence into the system. And that's in some sense in opposition to our founding fathers who said education is a local responsibility. Well, at some point, I think education is the future of the nation, and therefore it has to be a national responsibility. And so I think we're going to have to make some kind, my opinion, we're going to have to make some kind of change so that the benefits of the local control are very strong. It's a variety of things, but the communication between states has to be improved. You've got to preserve the states as authorities, but there are methods, I think, whereby the states can start talking to each other. Anyway, that's one of our problems.
So let's just look at some of these other issues that came up. In terms of the teaching of science, often what's needed is a really great teacher. So of the scientists you've known, of the physicists you've known, for example, I mean, who were the great characters?
Oh, gee.
Fermilab is named after Enrico Fermi.
Enrico Fermi, tremendous person. I knew him and met him, and he was someone, wonderful guy to talk to because he was so perceptive. And Richard Feynman is another great man to talk to. The knack of Mr. Feynman was you couldn't ask him a stupid question. No way. Because he would listen to the question and he would reword it by interchanging two words here and two words there, and suddenly it was a different question. He'd scratch his head and say, "Leon, that's a good question. I never thought of that." Well, you know, you walk away from probably one of the most outstanding scientists of our times, and you know, he praised you. You know, you're dancing on air. It's a wonderful. He was a human being, you know, and a great, great physicist. One wonderful one to talk to. My own mentor at Columbia was I.I. Robbie. It's interesting that Robbie, who got his PhD in Europe and then settled at Columbia University, and J.R. Oppenheimer, the gentleman who was in charge of the nuclear bomb at Los Alamos, he went to Europe and got his PhD and settled on the West Coast. And these two guys founded schools which spread good science teachers all over the nation and made it possible for the U.S. to be hospitable to the influx of refugees during and after World War II. So these were guys who did tremendous things. And Robbie was a man filled with wisdom. He was very wise. He also advised us. I thought he was sort of nuts, but he said, and these were all corridor discussions. We'd sit on the floor and he'd lean against the wall and tell us what life is like. And he said, "After you've done a few experiments, I advise you to go to law school, get a law degree, and run for office." Well, Robbie was an advisor to Eisenhower. Eisenhower had been Columbia University president and took Robbie to Washington very often and eventually started, after Sputnik, the science advisory situation in the White House, and Robbie was important in all of that. And he knew all about advising leaders, but he said the power is in being elected. And so he urged us to run for office. And I must say, there's a scientist, a physicist at Fermilab who's running for Congress in a Rock Rib Republican area as a Democrat because he was inspired by that idea that we have to be elected. And, you know, you have a Congress that's 97% lawyers or some number like that. That's dangerous. You want a mixture of professions and experiences in the Congress so you can have wisdom on the many, many different things.
There are two questions there. One is, we'll talk about the science debate and the whole notion of scientific literacy and the spreading of science throughout the political arena. But one of the questions I tend to ask people is, who is the wisest person you knew? And who is the smartest person you knew? And what's the difference?
There's a difference. I don't know if I could articulate it, but I would quickly pick Robbie. He died at the age of 90 and probably 10 years ago. But he had a vision of the world, which he shared with his students, that was profound. He had a vision of science as sort of the saving grace. He was worried about many things in modernization, and he was concerned about education in a deep way. And one of his, you know, wise things was this notion that we need a distributed sense of knowledge of how science works. And he was very worried about science literacy. Although he's also worried about a student body that was very capable. The physics department at Columbia was awesome. There were five or six Nobel laureates. Charles Townes invented the laser. He was in Columbia. Willis Lamb, another Nobel Prize winner for measuring something, which is in the literature called the Lamb shift. Robbie himself, and there was Japanese Yukawa at Columbia at the time, and the first Japanese Nobel laureate, and so on. And he built this department. And one of his wise things was that when a person applies to this department as a graduate student, he wouldn't worry about the college record. He says, look, kids in college, they're disturbed, their hormones are raging, they're doing many things. You've got to give them another shot. Let this department be very loose. Warn them that they're going to have to work hard. And after 2 years of course taking, there'll be a crucial exam. Warn them that this is not easy. But let them have a shot at it. So a lot of students that came to Columbia would never have gotten into Princeton, Yale, Harvard because of their high standards. And every time there'd be somebody who was a winner, you know, a profound guy. A guy who did change the way we do physics. That's wisdom in many ways. He also visualized Europe after the war as needing a big laboratory so that all the European countries could collaborate. And he was one of the founding movers in the formation of something called CERN, the European Research Laboratory on the Swiss-French border, where the big machine is now going. He was a push to that. He said, U.S. ought to help Europe by forming this organization that would compete with us. Otherwise, we'll wipe them out. You know, but if all the European countries get together and lick their World War II wounds, and that's what happened. So CERN is now one of the great laboratories in the world, and they're competing with us. We love to hate them. It's much better to ski in CERN than it is to ski in Illinois, I'll tell you that. I don't know if you can ski in Illinois.
And the smartest?
Oh, the smartest, that's easy. That's Richard Garwin. Richard Garwin is a physicist who...
Didn't he work on Star Wars?
Oh, he worked on everything.
What Reagan used to run.
He was involved with that. He graduated from the University of Chicago. He was a Fermi student. And Fermi often said Richard Garwin was the smartest student he ever had. And Fermi had a lot of smart students.
Didn't they also say, sorry to interrupt, but wasn't also this one-line joke that people used to say in response to the idea of democracy, you mean everybody gets the same vote like Fermi? Remember that joke?
No.
I think there was some...
Is it good?
Yeah, it was supposed
to
be.
Come
obviously
on.
Not this time, but it was supposed to be that people were sort of basically saying, how could you possibly have a democracy when you'd be reducing somebody's intelligence like Fermi just to one vote like the rest of the people?
I think, yeah.
So anyway, Garwin?
Garwin then went to work for IBM, and I think in a short time he was... irreplaceable. I remember once the CEO of IBM was looking for Garwin and called him up, and the secretary said, he's out of town. Well, where is he? Well, I don't know. He didn't let me know. Well, you'd think the CEO would be a little irritated. Instead, a very polite note was sent around to all the scientists saying, please, when you're leaving town, let your secretary know where you are in case you need it. And so Darwin organized a protest against this restriction on his freedom. It was pretty amazing. But anyway, Garwin is a guy who solves many problems. And in the beginning, he spent a lot of time in the arms business, consulting with the Pentagon, and probably was one of the guys who contributed strongly to the success of Teller's hydrogen bomb. He was very gung-ho to make sure that we would not be threatened by the Soviets and so on. But little by little, he got worried about that, and eventually got more interested in disarmament and became very active in trying to control nuclear weapons. And again, always with cogent advice, he single-handedly probably protected all of us against atmospheric disaster with the SST. That's right. And he argued cogently that it's noise level, it's exhaust gases, that if we had, you know, the number of SSTs that we now have and the number of standard 747s and things like that, the atmosphere would be unbreathable. You know, he was very logical in this. So he's done a lot of wonder, and he's very smart. You know, and he loves to solve other people's problems. So he'll drop anything. Somebody calls him up and says, "Dick, we have a problem here." He'll say, "Lock the door. I'll be right there," and goes and solve people's problems. But he just has a repository of a command of knowledge. We worked together on one experiment, which took 36 hours, a major discovery we made. And the whole experiment took 36 hours. And probably, if not for Garwin, it would have taken maybe 36 days. I don't know, but he had some ideas as to how to make the experiment very quickly. It was one of these things where I drove from Columbia to the laboratory. Columbia Laboratory was 20 miles north of the city. And Garwin had not been in the city, and when he called me and I said, come over, I have an idea about an experiment, because one of our colleagues, Madame Wu, Chinese-American lady, has some results. So we came over that evening, it was Friday evening, and we talked about it, and there was a graduate student there puttering around with some of his thesis experiments, and we said, that's just the experiment we need. So we took apart the student's experiment. The student started crying. We said, don't cry, everything will be all right. And then in a day and a half and so on, we had a new experiment set up, and we found that a long-held notion, get this now, of mirror symmetry was not a correct theory. For years, 50 years maybe, people said if you have a lot of experiments in this room and one wall is a mirror, and you take a videotape and you photograph either the real world or the mirror world, could you possibly tell the difference? And all the physicists would say, you can't tell the difference. The mirror world is a perfectly feasible real world. And in our experiment, we found a particle whose mirror image doesn't exist. Well, you know, there are ideas in which the muscles of the brain haven't been used along those lines.
So, but the joy of science, obviously, for you is palpable. If you couldn't have been a scientist, what else? What would you have liked to have done instead?
Well, a concert pianist. That's
concert
good.
Pianist.
I like that idea. What else? Oh, I think realistically.
You like music?
I love music. But I can't play, I don't know, and fingers don't do what I want them to do. I think, actually, to be more serious, I would be a teacher. I am a teacher.
You are a teacher.
But I would be a full-time primary school teacher. I think I would like to do that.
You're probably going to get some offers.
Well, yeah, but I just watch a good teacher with children, and it's just a pleasure to see that. And when at the end, and I see this a little bit in even when I teach in undergraduates and or in a high school I started, and when you've done something right, you're surrounded at the end of the lecture by the students who keep asking questions. You know, you've stirred them, and then they have questions. And that give and take after the lecture is just wonderful.
What are the most important mistakes you've made? What did you learn from them? What would you do differently?
There's one experiment. It was something called a discovery of the charmed quirk. You could say it trippingly from the tongue. The discovery of the charmed quirk.
The Glashow thing we were talking
about.
Yeah,
that was Glashow thing. But we were after a quirk. And I missed it not only once, not only twice, but three times in three different accelerators. I first tried the experiment at the Lodge Brookhaven Accelerator. That was in 1968. And we had a lot of data, but the apparatus, it was like sort of looking for a star using the, instead of the Zeiss lens, you use a Coca-Cola bottle. So the optics was not very good. Our apparatus was crude in the interest of speed, and we missed the particle. It was right in our data, but hidden by background garbage junk. Then we tried it again in an experiment in Europe because I wanted to use the European machine at CERN. It's a beautiful place, and on the weekends there's nothing to do but go skiing and so on, and good food, all the advantages of being in Europe. And they had an interesting machine, and we were able to get on that machine, and we tried a different approach to look for this charm thing, and we missed it. Didn't see it. Yet it was there. Then Fermilab came on the air. It started its experimenting program in 1972.
Are there other people looking for this thing at the same time, by the way?
Nobody. We were on a lead, you know, in a sense. In 72, but by this time, more and more people were getting interested in the experiment. And again, at the new Fermilab machine, for complicated reasons, our apparatus was not able to find this particle. And 2 years later, Mr. Samuel C.C. Ting led a group back at Brookhaven with more modern apparatus, more modern detectors facilities, and he found the particle. And then a good friend of mine at Stanford almost simultaneously,
Bert Richter,
found that same particle. So there was a joint. They fought each other because they were within hours of which one was first, so they shared the discovery. And went back and looked at the data, and there was back in the original Brookhaven experiment a little shoulder in the apparatus that we had argued about. Is that a particle or is that just some background? So that was interesting. I missed it three times. Nobody can hold up experiences that stupid.
what was the last book you read for pleasure, just out of curiosity?
Book I read for pleasure.
What books do you read?
They're usually detective story books. Who's our famous detective story writer?
You'd be surprised how often that's the answer from scientists, by the way.
Huh? Yeah.
But
these are, it's hard. I read it sometimes on airplanes, but usually on airplanes I'm worried about being interviewed, so I have to prepare and know everything, or something else like that. But I like, you know, good, well-written detective stories are great, and some are better than others. Who's the guy who writes mostly books about lawyers and juries and stuff like
John
that?
John Grisham.
Grisham, yeah, I like him. In fact, I met him, and he was a very charming guy. Whoever introduced him to a group of us said he's the runner-up to Shakespeare, and he just, you know, lambasted the guy. He says, Shakespeare, what are you talking about? I just tell stories. You like my books, you like the stories, you put them down, you forget about them. until my next book comes out. He had no pretensions that he was a great writer, but he certainly was a good storyteller. Is a good storyteller.
Let's do a quick thought about this Science Debate 2008.
Yeah.
Because that's a fairly large group gathering momentum now who are arguing for there to be a science debate with the candidates, whether it happens or not. It's still a huge number of people are now pushing for what could be a very powerful science literacy movement as well at the same time.
Yeah, well, about 60,000 scientists have signed a petition to all candidates, I guess there are three now, to participate in this debate. And we're not getting encouraged by the principals. You know, I'm sympathetic to candidates who are asked to debate science. They are not scientists. They don't know science. And they do what you hope they would do when any of them were elected president. They'd surround themselves with good advisors. The more they knew about science, you know, from their backgrounds, which is not much, but some of them may be more into trying to educate themselves in science than others. The idea of campaigning for them to be interested in science is the issue, really, because it is our belief as a scientific community that never, I go way back to pre-Civil War times, as you can notice. And
back to the beginning of the universe.
Yeah, I was there. Yeah, it was a terrible noise. there's never been a more important time for science to occupy the leadership of nations, and I say that, being aware that maybe this has been said before, but we're in a period of tremendous uncertainty, and I can make a list of all the issues that will face the next president. And if you look at them, the first on my list is global climate change. I'm very alarmed by the data and the events that are supporting the estimation, and even showing that the estimations were too conservative, that the world is in for a major change due to warming, and that if we don't take, you know, precautions very soon, there'll be a tipping point, and there'll be awesome possibilities of sea level rising and so on. I accept these things as very distinctly possibilities, and so that implies many things. And people are hoping, well, somehow solar energy and geothermal energy and these many, many different possibilities, all of which will help and ease the transition, because along with global climate change, there's energy, the sources of energy. What are the sources of energy? If we keep using coal the way we're using it, and the sequestering doesn't quite work as well as we hoped it might work, then there's an issue of what energy sources you need. Again, a scientific challenge, if you like, to do that. I think we're going to have a change in lifestyle. And that's my reading of the experts, the general, many climate people and energy experts and so on have looked at all these things. They're all will show up and be helpful at the level of 5% or 3% or 10% or 12%. But ultimately, we cannot have the kind of automobile society we have now. You know, and the automobile encouraged suburbs and shopping centers all over the place. And that's not going to be feasible. So we need substitutes for that, a change of lifestyle. And that tells you again that we've got to have a public that's comfortable with these scientific issues, so that they're not, you know, bowled over by nonsense statements. And there are lots of people who will cite, you know, absurd objections to what's going on. Oh, well, climate change happens every 1,000 years. That's been looked into in great detail by these experts. They go back 10,000 years. And there's been nothing like what we have now, tracking the energy, the temperature of the atmosphere, and the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, and it tracks identically. Nothing like that ever happened. We never had this large increase in atmospheric temperature changes over 10,000 or more years. So anyway, these are serious problems, and I think everything points to many, many issues that have to do with science. Almost anything you look at that's coming up before Congress, immigration, yes, even the deficit, how much national defense issues. Clearly, terrorism is a very important issue that we have to pay attention to. All of these things have science sides. And if we don't have a public that takes part in this, you're giving up democracy. This is a democratic society, and people should know about it. I'll bet you anything, if you take a poll somewhere in an audience, you say, how many nuclear weapons do you think we have on alert? They'd say, why do we have nuclear weapons on alert? Who are we aiming them at? Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, the Russians. Well, the Cold War was over 15, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Why are we aiming weapons at them? And are they aiming weapons at us? Well, if we're aiming at them, they're probably aiming at them. Why? I mean, who justifies that? I think we need to have a public that's interested in these issues and that asks these questions. And so, yeah, you start with kindergarten and you do better, but a public understanding of science is something that has to go right away and go at all levels, from pre-K through the grown-ups, the parents, the citizens that have to make decisions and go along and try to ask their government, why are we doing these things? So I call it the Oprah Winfrey fantasy. If we could get Oprah to be interested in science, boy, we could really be ahead. She doesn't answer my telephone call.
She probably thinks you're the other Letterman.
Yeah. Maybe.
With a tease. What are you optimistic about?
I think yesterday was a good day to be here because I was optimistic about the scientists, the neuro guys, the neuroscientists, talking about their progress in understanding how the brain works, and supplemented by the cognitive psychologists who also are in that goal, that phase. And of course, you have a large number of neuroscientists who are applied neuroscientists, which is teachers. They're applying their notion of children's behavior, and there's if the communication can be improved so that people in Maine know what the people in California are doing, and there's communications among the teachers and the educators and the scientists, and that's beginning to happen. It's still uncoordinated, but we have a messy system, and we've got to somehow install some national strategy and superimpose that on a system which has so many varied components, you know. So I think I'm optimistic that we can organize ourselves to make a better educational system. We have to, and that necessity, I think, will be satisfied. We need, you know, coherence. We need a new election. that we'll get. And I'm very confident that we have a good chance of organizing ourselves to do a lot better in the education system. And one of these kids, and I'm very happy with what's going on in China and India. People say, oh, well, we can't compete with them. And I would rather cross out the word compete and say collaborate. We can collaborate with them, and that's important. Competition and collaboration are often, you know, very, very similar. I mean, we have this laboratory in Geneva. We compete with them, but we also collaborate with them. And you can do both. In order to collaborate with them, we have to know enough science to read the papers they write and understand them and show them what we're doing along those lines. But some little kid in China is going to work on a cure for senility, and I'm in a hurry. And I want that. I think the fact that good science is going to pour out of China and out of India are very good things for us, good customers and progress in understanding the world we live in, and maybe alleviating disease and poverty and the other things we still have to do.
So you were talking there about aging and so on and so forth. Let me go back to that question I did earlier about the God thing. Is there anything else out there, or is it just quarks?
Well, you know, I'm a scientist, so if there's anything out there that we don't know about, then we're, you know, you need to have, I mean, I'm not a believer, but if there were data, you know, that indicated that there are events which are counter to the laws of physics as we know them, that would be a very impressive discovery. But over the 1,000 years of recorded, you know, sort of reasonably good observations, nothing like that has ever shown up yet. So,
we'll close on this. But I'm still there are still these issues that keep coming up in physics, like the Bell's inequality, John Stuart Bell. Issues that David Bohm has talked about non-locality and so on, that seem to leave open the sense of the, the standard model doesn't seem to fully answer. Do those things still give you pause?
The quantum theory is not an easy thing to grasp. Richard Feynman had an easy way of teaching the quantum theory, and the way he did it got him into trouble with women drivers. But policeman stops a woman driver. "What's wrong, officer?" "So you were speeding." "Oh, no, I wasn't speeding." "Yes, I clocked you at 60 miles an hour." "Aha," she says. "That's crazy. I've only been driving 20 minutes. Now, well, I'll explain it to you later, but it's... But in a sense, that's the quantum theory. But the quantum theory is, somebody said nobody understands, some famous physicist, nobody understands the quantum theory. It works. It works in an enormous way. Everything you know about cell phones and quantum and computers and the incredible number of things that we now know on the atomic and subatomic and nuclear level are governed by the quantum theory. Einstein himself was opposed to the quantum theory, but he gave up on arguing that it's incorrect, and he decided it is a correct theory, but he decided then that it was not the final word because he didn't like the idea of probability. You know, if you're walking on Michigan Avenue in Chicago and you see yourself in the store window, you see a guy in the window dressing a mannequin, haha, and you see yourself and you say, "Not too bad." So now, how did that happen? Well, the sun has photons. Einstein got the Nobel Prize for the photoelectric effect, that light produces electrons when it hits a surface. So the sun's photons hit your face and they're reflected from your face towards the window. Now, some of them go through the window because the guy dressing the mannequin sees you. So he gives those photons. But some of those photons are reflected from the window and come back to you and you see yourself. What decides whether a photon will go through the window or come back? And the answer is, it's totally probabilistic. Or, you know, if Einstein always talked about Deralta, the old man. He talked about God, but only as a substitute for nature. Nature is such that the probability is 8% that the photon will come back and 92% that it'll go through the window. And that's all that nature can tell you about is a probability. And Einstein hated that notion, that he couldn't make an exact calculation. But it turns out over and over again, experiments bore out the notion that quantum mechanics is a spooky theory and doesn't behave in accordance with the good old Newtonian world in which things happen according to some law of physics. There, you have to put in this probabilistic factor. And when you do that, then you get the right answers and you can build cell phones and computers and giant computers and all the microelectronics we have today comes out of that understanding. So I think that's not, the quantum theory is, and there are people that don't like the formulation or are hoping they can make a better formulation, and I give them all the encouragement. But so far, to use the quantum theory as a physicist, it's there, it's usable, and you're only worried about a conceptual problem that gave Einstein a lot of trouble, and people who respect Einstein have followed him in being looking for a sharper way of talking about the quantum theory than we have. But what's more interesting is the frontiers now opened up by astrophysics, because those guys are going to really change our worldview. And it's at Fermilab, when I was director of Fermilab, I hired a bunch of astrophysicists to come and live at Fermilab, like Rocky Cobb and David Schramm and Michael Turner. These were outstanding astrophysicists, and we built a good astrophysics group. Now, what has an astrophysics group got to do in a laboratory that's devoted to the smallest things, the quarks and leptons that are inside the nuclei of atoms? Well, it turns out there's a deep connection. The Big Bang Theory says in the beginning everything was particles. And so there were these incredible number of particles whizzing around, smashing into each other, separating, and eventually as it expanded and cooled, they came to be a sort of sticking together, and out of that came protons and neutrons, and eventually nuclei, and then along came an electron and made an atom, and now we could employ chemists. They had something to do because we made atoms, and chemistry is the subject of atomic reactions. So we have a huge knowledge, useful and also aesthetic, if you like, picture of how the world works. And all of a sudden, these astronomers come out and they say, you know, this expanding universe is speeding up its expansion. Well, that's a blow. That was totally unexpected. And that's called dark energy. We gave it a name, so we have something to talk about, but we don't know what it is. What is the mechanism by which these galaxies, each galaxy has billions of suns, and suns may have, I don't know how many planets per sun, and they're all going away, and they're speeding up. Their expanding is pushing them. We don't know what it is. And so that's a mystery at the frontier of our knowledge. So that's very exciting. Somebody, maybe a little kid in a village in China or India, but hopefully maybe somebody in San Diego or New York someplace will find a clue to this great puzzle. But the fact that we have a puzzle is very good. You know, we don't understand it.
Leon Lederman, thanks very much.